Okay. I'm going to call the House Education, Health Education and Social Services meeting to order. It is about 7 minutes after 3:00. And those present are Representative Sisner, Representative Faircloth, Representative Seaton, and myself, Wilson. My Hess aide is Becky Rooney, and our Hess secretary is Kelly Burnett, and Rob Sylvester is our moderator. If you have any cell phones on, please shut them off. And we only have one bill on the schedule today, and that is Senate Bill 100, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Programs. And Senator Ellis, come forward and explain your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I really, really appreciate this opportunity to bring this bill before you today. I'm joined, for the record, I'm Johnny Ellis, representing Midtown and Downtown Anchorage in the Alaska State Senate. I'm joined by my very wonderful and competent staffer, Kate Herring, who's lived with this bill and got it this far in the process. The legislation is very straightforward. It addresses some much-needed and long-overdue tune-ups or updates, if you will, to Alaska's substance abuse statutes. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have a whole list of statistics, but I think you all, as members of the Hess Committee, are very familiar with the enormous human tragedy and enormous public and private costs to our budgets and to our businesses and to our families all across the state of substance abuse. In fact, when I ride around with the police or the community patrols, they all sort of with gallows humor laugh that they would be out of a job if not for Alaskans abusing substance abuse at enormous rates, embarrassing as we stack up in the national statistics. So we're all familiar with that, but that's the setting or springboard for this legislation. And the bill before you today just makes three very common sense changes to the law. One of the most important, and it's one that brought folks together in the state Senate, was the idea of mandating in state-funded treatment programs that pregnant women go to the front of the line for treatment. Top of the list, front of the line. And that's related to the concern all across the board for the high cost and human tragedy of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And if we can prevent even one of those unfortunate circumstances, the just besides the human cost and the human tragedy involved, the enormous public cost and budget impact of avoiding one of those outcomes, birth outcomes, is something that everyone wants to accomplish. So it seems like common sense to require that pregnant women go to the front of the line. Another important provision in this legislation is the requirement that we require through the state statute and the Department of Health and Social Services the use of evidence-based and research-based treatment programs. There has been, and this is a term of art that comes in an update of statutes all across the country and in various states. It comes from a recognition of policymakers and budget writers that people really are tired of just giving scarce resources for substance abuse. And I actually am an advocate for expanding those. But to make sure that we have our statutes in place that we require research and evidence-based treatment programs in our state. People are tired of giving public money to programs that cannot prove that they have any chance of success or significant chance of success. And the cautionary note for the committee is that if you demand an 85 or 90% or even a 65% success rate in substance abuse treatment programs, you'd be way off the mark. I think if you study look at the studies, know that there are various levels of success for various treatment programs. And that it often takes several times for people to become successful in treatment programs, if ever. And so we are requiring, though, that the treatment programs that we fund would be evidence-based and research-based. They can report results to the department and justify future funding. So it's just very basic common sense. And people would say, well, we've done missions and measures. Why in the world wouldn't we have this requirement? Well, we just never have. Mm-hmm. And it's a recognition of something that Governor Murkowski did, and I was a bit of a Murkowski critic, not alone here in that, but one of the things that I was very supportive of was the effort to bring together the substance abuse and mental health issues in the Office of Behavioral Health in the Department of Health and Social Services. The jury was out for a while there, but the jury is in now. That has been a great success. Makes all the sense in the world because of all the co-occurring the folks that are mentally ill and have substance abuse, a co-occurring substance abuse situation. And so the department, the state of Alaska, has really made progress. This is the next logical step to requiring statute, evidence-based and research-based treatment treatment programs through this new division or office. And the third piece here, some people, this is another element of the bill that has brought people together from various parts of the political spectrum. It is a requirement or a prohibition on discrimination against faith-based approaches to substance abuse treatment. You know, we have many public facilities and prisons and other facilities across the state, and this would be, and it's not been a big conflict or problem, but I want to avoid that in the future. It is a prohibition against discrimination against faith-based initiatives in substance abuse treatment. They have to be effective. They must meet the same standards that the secular or non-faith-based treatment programs, but it's a recognition on my part, and I hope on others' parts as well, that different people respond differently to different kinds of approaches. The same program doesn't work for everyone. So if someone in prison or some other public program can respond to a treatment program based on the acknowledgement of a higher power and a faith-based approach, we're not talking proselytizing, we're talking about acknowledgement of a higher power, and AA has the faith component to it as well. That works for some people. A more secular, non-faith-based approach may work for others, but why not have the option to do whatever works, and as a way to stretch our scarce public dollars for treatment. Makes all the sense in the world to me, and I hope it does to you as well. So those are the three elements of the bill. There were other pilot project in the bill for certain kinds of treatment that we're going to wait and discuss next year with the Palin administration, the finance committees, and the Mental Health Trust Authority. But so the remainder of the bill that's before you today, are just these common sense tune-ups that received unanimous support in the Alaska State Senate, and I hope they find favor with you today.
Okay, thank you very much. And this committee is very pleased with especially the fact that you're giving priority to evidence-based programs. This committee met during the interim last year and really worked out some, we actually worked on spending health care dollars wisely, and that we came up with 8 recommendations, and that was one of the recommendations.
Perfect.
So the committee appreciates the bill, and Representative Gardner has a question for
you. Thank you. First, I'd like to say, Madam Chair, to remind you and anybody else in the audience who maybe wasn't aware of this, but we had decided last year that the HES committee would focus on doing everything we could to address the alcohol problem in this state. And I have to say that our progress is incremental.
Yes.
But there's a lot to do, and this is a big step for that. But my question for you, Senator Ellis, has to do with experimental treatments. And while I certainly applaud focusing on evidence-based practices and trying to assure that we're spending our money wisely, there's a lot we don't know about effective ways to address problems. And as you pointed out, different things work for different people, and I just want to be sure that we leave room in these requirements for experimental programs and new ways of tackling the issue.
Thank you. If I could pitch that to my staffer here.
Through the Chair, Representative Gardner, we do address that because...
Would you state your name?
Oh, sorry. For the record, this is Kate Herring, staff to Senator Ellis. We do realize that Alaska is often the first frontier of research, and especially with the high incidence of substance abuse and alcohol abuse disorders here. So in our definition, we did allow for not only evidence-based, research-based, but also consensus-based and promising practices, just so that we don't limit promising practices that could be going on front-of-the-line research here in Alaska.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On page 7, line 27, I'm trying to figure out how, where it says the department may not fund a proposed program or project that has been previously funded under the section unless the applicant provides satisfactory evidence of success of the program or project. And I'm concerned that you come in, you get funding 1 year, you're not going to have the evidence of the success of the program in 1 year, and it would seem that this says you may not fund it a second year unless it demonstrated that it had success in the first funding year, and that seems to be a very tall standard, and I'm wondering if that's what's meant, or am I misinterpreting that?
Through the chairs, Representative Seaton, we would certainly hope that we'd work with the department to make sure regulations around this would not let that happen. We'd work this through the regulations.
Follow-up, Representative Seaton?
Yeah, and Madam Chair, if we put it in the statute that the department may not fund a proposed program for a second year unless it's demonstrated this, I don't want us to get someplace we don't want to be and require the department to either violate the law by funding it a second year if it hasn't demonstrated satisfactory evidence of success.
Through the chair, I just, Representative Seaton, I see your point. I guess I wasn't reading this language as strictly as you are, and presumed that within regulations the department could make sure there was enough time there to handle that. So, I mean, I guess we can consult with someone from the department if they think that is so tight as you perceive it to be, to restrict them on a year-to-year basis.
Representative Gardner, do you have something on that point?
On that point, I would ask whether programs are funded on an annual basis. I mean, could there not be a pilot project that's, say, a five-year program, and then you come back after 5 years and want to renew it?
Well, it says may not fund, and lots of times it says shall not fund, and shall not means absolutely not, but may doesn't
right.
that give a little
but
bit of...
But it doesn't say annually or this year.
Yeah. Okay, so. Representative Faircloth.
Well, just to follow up on Representative Gardner's comments, usually grants are awarded, or they can be awarded for multiple years. So there could be, I was reading up in G, if the grant award is a two-year funding cycle versus a one-year, then that may take care of it, or a three-year or four. But I think that that's a good catch because that's not what you want to do. You're absolutely right that 1 year may not produce the success and that measurable goal, but on year two, after the clientele is brought in and scientifically those measures are analyzed, then you may see success. You've got to get a base year in there somewhere, so how do you know where real success is on 1 year? So
we have somebody from the department that just snuck in, so.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Bill Hogan. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services, and as I was walking up, I was about to say the same thing that Representative Wilson said, and that is that the language does not say shall, so I think the word may does give us some flexibility from 1 year to the next about whether or not we will fund a program. We are moving toward what we are calling performance-based contracting or funding, though, that we clearly want programs to produce and produce clear outcomes. We want to know that programs are actually helping people. So I actually think that the language and a lot of the language in this bill actually reaffirms the direction that we're going in the department.
Okay, Representative Cisna.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm reading this differently, and I want to check this because the way I'm reading it, I would hope would in fact be true, and that's that the department may not fund a proposed program or project that has been previously funded under this section unless the applicant provides satisfactory evidence of success of the program or project. And the way I'm reading it is that if the program isn't keeping those records, isn't having evidence-based sticking to a model, and the model does have an assessment, not of the good things that are happening necessarily, but of the potential good things, that it's got measurements, that if it's not doing that, then I really question that we should be funding. If in fact we're talking about evidence-based, you've got to have measurements in place, and you've got to be measuring.
And I think,
now, am I wrong?
I think what we were talking about a little bit, though, was if this was the first-year grant and they weren't able to prove at the end of the first year that there was progress, but yet maybe by the end of the second year you'd be able to because you would have data from the first. But I don't know. So, Senator?
Sorry, Senator Ellis.
No. Either way. I think that something like this is absolutely necessary to build the kind of support to fund our treatment programs in the state. As you know, a couple of years ago, there was a significant cut in the treatment programs across the state. And when I, you know, disagreed with that and tried to talk to my colleagues on various sides of the aisle about why they supported a cut in treatment programs, when I thought we weren't investing enough public resources in treatment programs, there was a real skepticism that we actually had applied missions and measures that we apply generally to state government to these kinds of treatment programs, that we were investing a significant amount of money into. And so I thought we needed to go down this road of applying missions and measures and performance standards, and the department really, now that they have this new approach, collaborative approach in their department, to making sure that these treatment programs really measure up and have a reasonable chance of success and good use of the money. I'm going back and forth of trying to meet your concerns and then Representative Sisna's concerns as well.
Representative Faircloth.
Senator Ellis, I have a question. Is your intent on line 27 to preclude funding if someone is not meeting a measurement? It's not plus one. All things being equal, is your intent in this legislation not to allow funding by the department? And that answers the question, and we'll work with the words.
Well, in a single year, is that a condition that you're...
It, just as it states, if a project... Mm-hmm. Because a grant can be awarded for 1 year, so yes. If it's not successful, is your intent not to allow them to have funding, or is it you want the department to have latitude and that is a condition that they can consider?
Yeah. I believe, working with the drafter, that we were providing latitude in this language, that it was directive but not too restrictive.
So I would ask you for your consideration in this modification, and I'm not going to propose it now, just your response. On that same line, the department may insert the word consider and then add at the end of fund ing. So it would read, the department may consider not funding a program or project that has that. That's the latitude that... if that's the intent of the bill, then that addresses Representative Seaton. That's why I want to know, do you want latitude or not? Because no. We can insert it so that the words say the intent.
Through the chair, Representative, I think that's an elegant improvement to the language. I would support that strongly.
Any other comments? Okay, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Does someone want to...
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to make a conceptual amendment on line 27. The department may, after that, insert the word consider, not fund, and add ing. So the word would be now funding, and everything else stays the same.
Okay. We have conceptual amendment number one in front of us. Hearing no objections, it has been adopted.
Good work. I like this committee.
Well, any other? We do have some more testimony on the bill. So we have, is there anyone online at all? Is this one? Okay. Margaret Lowe, would you like to state your name and affiliation and your comments on the bill? Margaret, go ahead.
Yes, here I am.
All right. State your name and affiliation, and then tell us your comments.
My name for the record is Margaret Lowe. I am a trustee with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you about Senate Bill 100. I've lived in Alaska for a very long time, and I've seen the problem of substance abuse and alcohol addiction continue to increase and devastate the lives of Alaskans. I've had a personal research project going for the past 15 years, and all of the instances of child abuse and neglect that I have been connected with, I have not found one that does not have substance abuse as a part of the problem, and frequently it is really the cause of the whole problem. Improving life for children is cost-effective, and it is a moral responsibility for us. When I was Commissioner of Health and Social Services, we were beginning to be aware of the commonality of mental illness and substance abuse. And now we have established the Division of Behavioral Health to provide state-of-the-art treatment. We are in great need of much more treatment availability and treatment that is appropriate to each person and their personal situation. Circumstances such as mothers with young children, pregnant women, etc. I remember testifying before legislative committees years ago and being asked why, with more money being appropriated, the data showed the problem was growing. I'll say today what I said then. We need to spend far more money than we are currently spending. We need to spend the money on treatment facilities and personnel as our basic approach to prevention. With treatment available, we will have parents and young adults in recovery modeling health and wellness for our children and parenting children appropriately. I thank you for the opportunity to bring this important bill to your attention and certainly urge its passage.
Thank you very much. And are there any questions for Margaret? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if this is a question or comment, but I believe that if we had unlimited funds for treatment and we had good substance abuse treatment programs available for anybody who wanted or was willing to participate, we would still have to have other avenues of addressing this problem, because treating an existing problem is only part of the issue. We need to think about why we have such a problem and maybe do some other kinds of prevention or some other change in our culture. I don't know what the answer is, but it isn't just taking care of things after they happen. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and I think that exactly what you're saying is why I have tried to focus on prevention, because I think with the sort of scenario that you're setting, if we have children that are being raised in homes where parents are doing well, are healthy and well and not under the influence, everything, then we are raising children who are learning with good role modeling. And that's why I say that treatment also is a big piece of prevention, because as we have more people overcome the problem, they become then good parents and family people, and then modeling and the security and the stability that is put into children's lives is very different. And I think the reverse is true. When we see the amount of problem we have and see children being abused and neglected due to parents' inability to take care of them well, and we are then generating the problems for the future also.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Margaret. We do have, Jeff, did you want to testify? Jeff, Jesse, why don't you come forward and testify?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the members of the committee, and for the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And I'll just point out that this bill is really going in the direction that the Mental Health Trust has been trying to take our treatment programs for some time. Again, a recognition that we need evidence-based practices is absolutely critical. One of the great frustrations for the trust has been to really try to get good, hard data out of our substance abuse and mental health programs so that we really can evaluate what their performance is and make more intelligent allocations of funding between various programs. It is pretty complex to do that, because often you have to be careful you don't set up the wrong incentive. So for example, you don't want programs taking the easiest to serve individuals just so they'll get better numbers on their outcomes. But as challenging as that is, this bill moves us in that direction of really starting to look at evidence-based practices. And we think in the long run, that's absolutely essential to having a really effective mental health and substance abuse treatment program. And of course, the emphasis in this bill on co-occurring disorders is critical as well. And that's also a work in progress. I mean, there continues to be significant resistance in the field, particularly the substance abuse field, to integrating mental health and substance abuse into a behavioral health system. We're continuing to work on that problem, work on that issue, and I think that the intent that this legislation will put into legislation is really very important in providing that policy level guidance from the legislature that we've had now from the executive branch since we reorganized the different divisions. So with that, I'll stop, let you know that we're certainly supportive of this, and answer any questions you may have.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may be for the committee, and it's just gnawing at the back of my brain, and I just need to say it out loud, and please respond. The only concern that I have with, or I have a concern with prioritizing pregnant women. And that said, I want them to be the first on the list, but I don't want someone to go out and get pregnant to become first on the list. And I don't know how you address that or even if it's a concern, but I know when people are in crisis situations that sometimes they don't make good decisions. And if the clientele hears that you get to be number one if you're pregnant, is that going to encourage, I know it's a large responsibility, but we're talking about people with coexisting disorders that may have mental disorders, and I believe it sounds bizarre too, but it's just hitting me that, oh, I certainly wouldn't want to encourage someone to have a baby because they couldn't get services, and that would somehow prioritize them to the top in not understanding those consequences.
Jeff. Through the chair, Representative Fairclough. Well, I think you raise an interesting point, because that becomes a problem in a lot of other areas. For example, if you have a child with a psychiatric problem, you're still under a lot of pressure to have DFYS take custody of that kid in order to get treatment. We keep trying to work on that, but that's a reality. And in fact, in my prior life as an attorney, I actually recommended to some parents that they let DFYS take custody of their kid, because there was no other way for them to get psychiatric treatment for their kids. So I don't think you're making this up, that if we create these priorities, that we create an incentive. I'm less concerned, frankly, in this area, intentionally trying to get pregnant in order to get alcohol treatment is a very extreme type of reaction. And to my knowledge and experience, if a woman truly was that adamant about getting treatment, I believe that most of our treatment programs would find a way to get that person into treatment. I don't think that your concern is totally unfounded, but I think in this particular instance, I would think that would be extremely rare. In fact, currently most programs actually already prioritize this population.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you. If I may just speak to having worked with some of these populations, alcohol's effect on the brain puts it more in line to get one in the position of being pregnant. And it's just a set of bad choices that all kind of come together. And the being pregnant might, once that's been realized, might actually help someone to rise above the alcohol's effect on their body. But I think that the numbing effect of alcohol, the brain, it's sort of temporary brain damage that's done, doesn't fit into the making the decision to get treatment and therefore to get pregnant for that. I don't think so. You know, it'd be good study.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This goes to the discussion we were having with the sponsor before we started the hearing, and that was, we had identified in previous hearings that fetal alcohol syndrome, one of the problems is that many times the damage occurs before the woman even knows she's pregnant. And so I share Representative Fairclough's, not the intentional pregnancy, but a person that is conducting themselves in a way in which they might get pregnant wouldn't be able to get that, be at the top of the priority until they were actually pregnant. And I think that at some point down the road, I can't quite see how to do it in this bill, but some point down the road, I think that we need, if we're going to work on preventing fetal alcohol syndrome in this state, we're going to have to work on the people that are exhibiting that behavior and have not just after someone's pregnant, but we're going to have to encourage that pre-pregnancy treatment and awareness. I don't know how to do it in here, but I just wanted to get it on the record since we had this conversation with the sponsor before the hearing that it was a concern of this committee that we move in that direction. And thank you, Madam Chair.
And I don't know what happens when people are admitted for treatment or when people are getting them lined up for treatment, but many times I've seen it happen when people admitted to the hospital, they didn't know they were pregnant, but because of what we automatically do, some of the blood tests and stuff like that, they found out they were pregnant when they didn't know it. So is that one of the tests that is automatically given or not?
Madam Chair, I don't really know whether a pregnancy test is routinely given in hospital settings in treatment settings.
Yeah, that's what I meant, treatment.
I can't answer that question.
I mean, you know, if it was within a pregnancy age, it would probably be a good idea, you know, but Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, I've reviewed some of the intake for treatment programs, and I think there are routinely questions about, do you think you might be pregnant, and then the follow-up would come based on those answers.
Okay. All right.
Well, Representative Gardner, through the chair, you know, what this discussion really points out, though, is one of the parts of alcohol treatment that just absolutely amazes me. You know, I'm a recovering alcoholic myself, have been through treatment, and it really amazes me how differently we treat alcohol from virtually every other health condition that we experience, despite the fact that it is without a doubt the most socially damaging health problem. And I think it has to do, frankly, with how alcohol use and the cultures and society's treatment of alcohol has grown up over the years. Originally, it was a moral issue. Drinking started out, you know, for substance abuse or alcohol abuse started out as a moral issue. Because when you think about it, what are the arguments that we hear about not having enough treatment available for people with alcohol problems? Well, the couple of things you hear are things like, well, treatment doesn't work. It's not effective. Well, in fact, we know that alcohol treatment, virtually any program that's evidence-based, even with the most severe alcoholics, often get 30 to 40% success rate, meaning abstinence after a year. And I've heard people in this body talk about, well, 30 to 40%, that's not a very good outcome. Why would we invest funding for treatment that's only 30 to 40% effective? And then I look at them and say, but look at people with diabetes. They routinely fail to follow doctor's orders, don't take their medication, don't watch their diets, they relapse, they end up back in the hospital with more health conditions. But I've never heard anyone suggest that, well, therefore, we should restrict the treatment for diabetes because that treatment's only 30 to 40% effective. Well, and then you hear the argument, but you know, alcohol use, that's voluntary. People choose to drink, you know, and if people choose to drink, it's not up to the state to provide funding for treatment for something that people undertake voluntarily. Well, putting aside for a moment the state's and society's interest in controlling the consequences of that drinking, look at smoking. We know that lung cancer is hugely connected to smoking. We know that smoking is at least as voluntary as alcohol use is voluntary. Now, we can argue the medical model of addiction back and forth, but it's certainly not different. Yet I've never heard a single individual in this body ever suggest that we should not fund coverage for lung cancer treatment because people chose to smoke. Frankly, there is a special place in hell for people that abuse alcohol. And you not only see it in this sort of public policy debate, but look at our confidentiality laws. There's a special place in hell for people that violate the confidentiality of somebody that's in alcohol treatment. There really needs to be a fundamental review of how our entire society, and in my opinion, our policymakers view this area of substance abuse. We know we can make a difference in this area, and yet consistently we choose as a society and as policymakers to choose not to take this issue on. And when you look at the societal costs and the financial costs, I don't have any other explanation than this historical context in which alcohol has grown up in our society. Anyway, I'll stop there. You got me started.
Well, and it is amazing that society, I think society looked at it that way because by far the majority of the of our society drinks and they don't want to give that up. And they, even the casual ones, even the person that just has to drink once in a while, they don't want to give that up. And so therefore, it's the bad guys, you know, but it's okay, you know, and it's a very interesting thing. And we finally have gotten to the point where we realize and acknowledge that smoking is really bad, no matter, you know, and that it's bad for you. And it's been accepted as in society pretty much that, you know, you shouldn't be smoking. But it's not accepted in society yet that you shouldn't be taking a drink. That's not been accepted yet. That's okay.
Or again.
Yeah.
Well, and Madam Chair, with all due respect, I didn't want to stop drinking either. And I thought I could manage this, you know, because, and I still have people tell me that, you know, you were a lot more fun when you were drinking. and it is hard. It is hard to realize you can't be a member of that club of drinkers anymore. But, you know, if as a society we want to allow people, which I think we should, the freedom to indulge in these sorts of things, then I think we also have a responsibility to manage the consequences for those that either because of genetic reasons or other issues, you know, can't handle their drinking. And it just seems to me, you know, when you look at the incredible costs in our prison system, our social welfare system, our child protection system, the number of divorces and the other issues that come up, to not take a more comprehensive attitude and approach to this is doesn't make any sense to me, especially when we now have the information we need about evidence-based practices to know that we can make intelligent investments in working on the problem.
Well, and I guess that because this is so strong in, for me too, is that at least smoking doesn't cause people to harm others. Drinking does, and in many different ways. So, anyway, is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? Come forward, please. Mr. Ford.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mike Ford, and I'm here on behalf of the Alaska Native Health Board. That's a tough act to follow. I think you've heard a pretty good description of two of the most significant issues that we face today, substance abuse and mental health disorders. It's hard to find an area that soaks up more of our public health dollars than these two issues. It's hard to find a family or a life that's not been touched in some way by these issues. And what I would just like to tell you, of course, is we're completely in support of Senate Bill 100. Any small steps we can make in this battle are good. And I look at this bill as a pretty small step, but it does some necessarily and important steps that we need to take in order to create some infrastructure. Our clinics around the state spend an enormous amount of time, an enormous amount of money to fight these two problems. And so anything we can do to make it better, then we urge you to do that. So we just want to go on a record and say that. But thank you for your time.
And that was Mike Ford.
Oh, sorry. Did I say that?
You know, you did say that.
I thought
you
I did. I could say it again, but.
Madam Chair, I just asked because I wanted to talk with him about something different afterwards.
Oh, I'll be here.
Okay. All right. Is there anyone else that would like to testify? Then we're going to close testimony. And any comments or motions from the floor? Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, I would like to move committee substitute for Senate Bill number 100 Finance. It's 25-LS0151/F with any
as amended
with any attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
All right. Hearing no objection, the bill has passed. Thank you very much and appreciate everyone's testimony, but I do want to, well, you guys can go, but
I do want to
speak with the committee since we're a little bit flexible with time today. During the interim, this is going to be a working committee, and so we are going to continue working, and we are going to work. I would like to work on alcohol, some alcohol things, and some uninsured type things. And so in July we're having a meeting, and I think I've sent everyone's probably gotten it in your office. If you haven't seen it yet, you probably will. But when is the best time in July? So please pick two of them so that we can kind of see which one is the of the two. We've got about four different dates, so if you can pick two of them, that would be the best. That would help us out to see when would be best for us to hold the meeting. And Penwar is in there in Anchorage, and so that probably would be a good time if we could do it around Penwar sometime. But, you know, do whatever you would, let us know when it's best for you guys. And so the first meeting is going to be on the uninsured, and we're going to try to pull together any information that we have anywhere on it, and we're going to try to deal with some of this stuff. So having said that, if you have suggestions, let me know. And having said that, this meeting is adjourned.